Hey. Did everyone get both of the sheets? You should all have a two-page sheet and a one-page sheet. Please speak now if you didn't get both. Okay? Fine. Now, this is our first class of the season. And the name of this particular class is Issues in Jewish Contemporary Society. What are we trying to achieve in this class? Livy, you have a seat? You want to stand? Fine, I don't mind if you stand, as long as you have a seat. The purpose of this class really is twofold, I think. Number one is to talk about issues that people find interesting, and on that note maybe we'll have a look at the list at the end and look at things which you might find interesting. And the second purpose of the class, which I think is the underlying purpose, which I think is the most important purpose, is really to address an unsaid question, which is, given that Judaism bases its answers to all questions on sources which are fundamentally a couple of thousand, at least, years old, all halakha is rooted in the Talmud, if not before. The Talmud is around 2,000 years old. Okay, it was put together 1,500 years ago, but the principles of the Talmud predate that some way, as we'll see in our oral law class on Sundays. So how can it be that a 2,000-year-old system has answers which are responsive to modern-day questions? That's really the underlying question that I think we're dealing with in this class, which is why I'm going to try and show you, not necessarily just today, but all the way through, I'm going to try and pick questions which are very contemporary and really answer them through the sources, which is how Jewish questions are answered. They're not answered by, well, what do I think, what do you think? I mean, I'm interested to know what you think, and you may or may not be interested to know what I think, but that's not really relevant, what we think. What's relevant is what the sources say, because we don't just make it up as we go along. Okay? Therefore, what I've given you is, on this double-sided sheet, I've given you a list of 62 topics, of which the first 31 are just ready to pull off the shelf, and we can go with them any time. And the second 31 are things that I'm thinking of working on, or in the process of working on, or halfway through, or a little bit through, or not really through yet. What I'd like you to do when you're feeling bored, or if you are feeling bored through this class at all, or feeling like a breather, is to just put a circle around the issues that you're interested in either set, in either the first 31 or the second 31, and then give it back to me at the end. And how many? As many as you like. As many as you've got time for. How long do you plan to stay here, Olivia?
A year.
A year, fine. So ring 40. but, I mean, you can do whatever you want. I can't promise that I deal with all of them in any particular order, or even that I deal with all of them at all, but I will try and deal with the ones that you are interested in. Yes?
How many issues do you anticipate we'll cover in the first?
Well, in the first semester, we've got 1 week, one issue a week. So we have, from now till January, approximately 10 sessions. Maybe a bit more, maybe 12, 13. Don't forget the Sukkot and Rosh Hashanah and da-da-da-da-da-da. Wednesday's a bad day to have a class this year, because Wednesday is Erev everything. It's Erev Rosh Hashanah, and it's Erev Sukkot, and it's Erev... So we'll see what we can do. Now, you can do that when you like, but you must be able to listen at the same time. So multitasking is a prerequisite for this class. What's that?
Tuesday.
I see. That's the first point that's been spotted in the class. Today's Tuesday. And therefore... You know something, Susie? It's very funny. From the moment that I woke up this morning, I've been convinced, maybe hopeful, that today is Wednesday. And it's not. And I've been trying to make it Wednesday all day. And it's just not happening. Never mind. All right. Thank you for pointing that out. So Tuesday, ring a few more. Okay, fine. Now let's go. What I'm doing today is I'd like to give you a bit of a teaser today. We're not going to cover a specific issue. We're going to talk about issues. And I think this is very valuable. Oh, the other thing I'd like to say to you is I'd like to try, because there are some people who were here last year, I'd like to try not to cover the ones I covered last year or at the end of last year so that people don't get repeats, but that should still bring us plenty of options. Fine. Now, what I've given you in this today sheet is I've divided it into four. And I want to talk about what changed, given that, I think the underlying question is, how can old sources deal with new issues?
So let's just identify what are new issues. I think that's the first step which will help us to work out what we're really trying to achieve.
So the question I've said at the top here is, how does the life of the Jew in contemporary society differ from that of the Jew in non-contemporary society, i.e. over the last, there have been Jews for 3,000 years, how does our life differ from theirs? Now, I'd like to suggest to you, is there something that people don't think about? People always assume in the modern world that nothing in the modern world is the same as anything ever has been before. This is a very common thing that people walk around. Everything's different today. Oh, it's all different today. When you think about it for a few minutes, you realise that a large amount of issues that we face in daily society are identical to the ones which were faced 100, 1,000, 3,000 years ago. As long as there have been human beings who are conscious, there have been these issues in place. And therefore, the fact that Judaism has a lot to say about these issues makes it automatically very contemporary, because these issues are still contemporary issues. Now, these are not the ones we're going to talk about in this class or in this course, but I'd like to mention a few. I've divided into three, Bein Adam L'Makom. Bein Adam L'Makom means between man and God. The issues that affect a religious person's life that one struggles with between man and God are no different on the whole than they ever were. Ahavat Hashem, Yirat Hashem, which we'll talk about on Shabbat, the Shabbaton. Loving God. Having a relationship with God. What is fear of God? What is love of God? What is emunah? What is belief in God? How do you translate the word emunah? Is it blind? Is it rational? All of these things are really serious issues that people grapple with. They're no different. Pick up the Rambam, pick up the Gemara. You know, they're things that Aristotle dealt with. They're things that everybody dealt with at all times in Jewish history. And therefore, they are and always have been contemporary. Tzadik v'ra lo, which is, why do bad things happen to good people? Which the official word for that is theodicy. Okay? Theodicy. Not the Iliad. No, silly joke. Theodicy, okay? Tzadik v'ra lo means, why do bad things happen to good people? The truth is that classically the question was always not why do bad things happen to good people, which is what always bothers us, but why do good things happen to bad people? Because why do bad things happen to good people assumes that we all know we're good. And the question is just, why are these things happening? Which classically was not really the question. People used to assume, well, they weren't good, so it's not a big surprise that bad things happen to them. But if good things happen to bad people, well, that's a big question, which is funny. But that's no different. Good things, bad things still happen to everybody. And therefore, these questions are as old as the hills. The meaning of life, okay, which is not a, Monty Python film, but that's not what I'm dealing with here. The meaning of life. Being, what's it all about? What's the purpose? What are we aiming for? What is the focus? Is it this world? Is it the next world? Etc. Classic paradoxes. Transcendence versus immanence. Is God very close? Is God in everything? Or is God so far away that I can't possibly connect and touch the being of God? And how do I bridge the two? Which is really fundamental to the whole Jewish religion. Think about the phrase Kadosh, 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 which means God is ultimately transcendent. Kadosh means distant and separate. And yet, Malach Kol Ha'aretz Kvodo, yet the whole world is full of God. We deal with that paradox daily in our prayers, in our thoughts. That's a classic paradox. Omniscience versus freedom of choice, which a lot of people still have an issue with. How can I have free will when God knows exactly what I'm about to do? And you're going to have to grapple with that question. Either you're going to have to decide, well, the two somehow go together and I'll never understand how. Or you have to say, well, I don't really have free will. Or you'll have to say, well, God doesn't really know everything. All of those three answers are problematic in their own ways. That's not a new question, but it's a very relevant question. Philosophy, theology, etc. So in all of those areas, I'd like to suggest that there are contemporary issues which have always been there. Then Adam L'Chaveiro, between man and his or her fellow man. Midot, how to be a nice person, is no newer now than it ever was. Klal Yisrael, what is the Jewish people, what is their role, who is a Jew? And maybe that's perhaps but more modern than it used to be, for reasons that we'll deal with during the course. Look through Pirkei Avot. What they talk about there in the ethics of the fathers, how to be a special person, you know, how to smile at other people when you meet them. That's not new. People have been miserable as old as they've been people, okay? And people have been trying to make them less miserable. Again, these are old issues which have current significance. And finally, Bein Adam La'atzmo, between a person and themselves, tshuva, tefillah, self-development, These are all fresh questions, which are also ancient questions, and therefore my first point, which is really the only time I'm going to make this point during the whole year, is that a lot hasn't changed. Therefore, issues in Jewish contemporary society are just the same as issues in Jewish ancient society. And don't forget that. Don't fall into the trap of thinking, because science has changed, that everything has changed. It's not true. B is areas where issues remain the same, but the applications have changed. And here it gets a bit more interesting. By the way, please ask questions. Don't let me just speak for an hour, otherwise I'll lose my voice. And it's not as interesting. Now, let's go. Areas where issues remain the same. And here I brought you a few sources. These are just teasers. We're not going to talk about these. I'm really sorry. If you want to get into each of these topics, we'll have to do it another time. Okay? But just think of the following. The Mishnah in Bava Kamma discusses a classic case, number one. Shnei kedarim shehayu mehalchim zeh achazeh. Two potters. What's a potter? Someone who makes pots. Okay. And if you say potter, they must be someone who makes pods. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Shnei kedarim shehayu mehalchim zeh achazeh. Two people who make pots, who walk after one after the other. There's two guys, okay, carrying pots on their heads or whatever it is, walking down the street. The nitkal harishon v'nafal, and the one in front trips over, is the case in Bava Kamma here. V'nafal, and he falls on the ground, and then what happens, like Laurel and Hardy? The nitkal hasheni barishon, and the second guy trips over the first guy and smashes his pot too. Who is liable to pay for the pots? They could be very expensive. So the first statement of the Mishnah here is, harishon chayav v'nitkal hasheni. The first one is liable for the damages of the second one, and the Gemara goes into pages and pages of discussion about this. Okay, fine. So I don't have guys walking down the streets carrying pots anymore. But just transpose this to two guys driving a car, and they're driving down the road, and one guy's driving. Have you ever been on the motorway in Israel, where the guy behind you is driving right up the back, you know, he feels like he's in your exhaust pipe, like you're looking in the mirror. So the first guy stops, and the second guy goes into the first guy. Who's responsible? And the whole discussion of the Gemara may seem like a rather abstract discussion about things that we don't do these days, but it's not really. You just have to transpose modern day examples into the cases in the Gemara. That's a very standard thing. Instead of camels and animals, think, you know, trucks and things like that. Number two, completely different topic. The Gemara here discusses the laws of interest, of lending on interest. I'm sure you're aware that a Jew is not allowed to lend on money on interest, with interest, to another Jew. That Elo Oibrim Veloisas, the following people are liable for the prohibition of lending on interest. Hamalver, the lender, Haloiver, the borrower, Haorev, the guarantor. Obviously, if I lend you money and somebody else guarantees that you'll pay the loan. The Ha'edim and the witnesses, okay. The Chachamim Omrim, and the rabbis added, Af Hasofer, even the scribe. What's the scribe? He's the guy that records the deal. He is liable because he is putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. Why? Because he's writing a contract allowing two Jews to lend interest on interest and borrow on interest with each other. So do we have scribes today? No. And certainly my PC is not liable for anything. Okay? But my lawyer is. Instead of a scribe, think a lawyer. The guy who's drafting the contracts, the people who are doing the deal, the agents who are putting the deal together. Are they the modern-day equivalent of the scribe? We don't have scribes today, but we do have lawyers. And I used to be a lawyer. I was for many years a real estate lawyer in London. And I used to have clients who used to lend money to each other on interest. And usually they were both non-Jewish, Jews, which was just useful because then there weren't any halakhic issues. But occasionally they were both Jews, and that was very problematic. And they're asking me to draft a contract that says, I'll lend to him and you'll pay me on interest, etc. Am I allowed to do that? Do I have to say, no, I can't do this? Is that going to lose me my job? Do I have to lose my job over that? Etc., etc. This is a very modern day application of a very old question. Yes?
So Jew can't lend to Jew.
Yes.
So if I lend to Jew my roommate
with interest.
You can lend money to him. In fact, it's a mitzvah to lend money.
Okay.
It's a mitzvah to lend everything. But you can't charge interest. Yes, Olivia?
How do banks work today then?
How do what?
Thank you.
So that's a good question. Banks do work, and the short answer to that question, because we can't deal with all of these issues, is that the nature of the transaction of a bank lending to a client is not poor man, rich man. It can be, but it's usually not. It's usually more of a business deal. Like, I want to buy a house, you happen to have hundreds of thousands of dollars, you'll lend them to me and I'll pay you back. It's more like a business transaction. And if it's structured in that way, then that's not what the halacha has a problem with. What the halacha has a problem with is I'm rich, I'm poor, you're rich, I go to you and you take advantage of the fact that I'm poor. That's what, and therefore you can structure a deal in a business way where it will work. Rachel, you had a question? Someone had a question.
Israel bonds.
You know something? We could ask a million questions, but I'm just telling you now that the modern day context is different, but the principle is the same.
The
answer is it's a problem. It's a problem, and it depends on the kind of interest that we're talking about. Is it penalty interest? And there are books this thick written on what is interest and what isn't interest. You know, when you become a professional and you're working in that field, you start getting into the exact issues. But there comes a point when you have to turn around and say, for whatever reason, I can't deal with this, someone else is going to have to deal with this, a non-Jewish solicitor or something like that. Now, you have to ask me afterwards, and I can go through all the different situations. I used to do all sorts of weird things when I was a lawyer. Lawyers, in professional life, you get into all sorts of interesting scrapes, which well, I could tell you about maybe. More an after-dinner speech rather than a shiur. Right, number three. Number three I'm not going to get into in detail, but it raises an interesting question. Listen to the question. I'm not going to learn the whole thing inside the text, but this is the story. The Gemara relates a story of two rabbis who were walking, who was walking down the street to give guest lectures in a certain town. Okay? And he met two rabbis from that town walking towards him. So the Gemara relates the following story. He assumed that the two rabbis walking towards him were coming to greet him, to escort him into the town. So he started, oh, how wonderful of you to come, how marvelous of you to meet me, you really shouldn't have, it was wonderful, thank you very much. And these two rabbis are now faced with a moral dilemma, a malachic dilemma. Do we tell him? Do we tell him that we didn't know he was coming and deflate him, make him look like a fool? Or do we say, well, of course, and how could you think, and which is not true, and we're kind of deceiving him. And one of the rabbis there says, we didn't know you were coming. And of course, the first rabbi feels like a complete idiot. And he feels very, very stupid in his games. He gets very upset. So the second rabbi of the two that were walking together says, why did you have to tell him? Just let him think that. So the first rabbi says, how can you deceive him like that? So he says, no, we're not deceiving him. He's deceiving himself. Because why should he think that we were coming to meet him? If he thinks something ridiculous, do I have a responsibility to change his view? Let him think what he thinks. We're not deceiving him. To which the Gemara then goes into a whole discussion of, well, what is deception? What? How far do I have to go in advertising my products to say good things about them and allow you to jump to your own maybe false conclusions? Or is that my responsibility? And from this Gemara about these three rabbis walking on the street, which seems like a rather quaint, almost humorous story, you end up with a very interesting halachic source for the debate on false advertising. When is advertising fair? What if I sell things and I say things about them? They're the best product in town, the best sneakers in the market, you know, and you believe that. Is that just more fool you? Or am I misleading you? How far can I go in representing myself when people come around to look at my house? Can I, you know, make freshly brewed coffee and bake bread and make it all feel like a, you know, show house? Is that deceptive? Or is that just kind of just sell my house? What about if I push cupboards against cracks in the wall? Is that deceptive so they won't see the cracks? And therefore, this rather interesting story leads to an entire discussion about modern-day advertising, the ethics, the morals, the halachas of advertising in this context. Turn over to page 2. So those are all things where I feel that the principles are all there in the Gemara, and really the cases are still the same, but they just changed from animals to trucks, from rabbis on the road to sneakers, etc., etc. And by the way, it's a very interesting question. You know, my son was bought a Rolex watch, but it wasn't really a Rolex watch. It was bought in Hong Kong for 50 cents. Like, and he was given this watch. Is that okay? I mean, he didn't think it was a Rolex watch, but he didn't know, should he wear it to school? Like, either way, either it's a real Rolex watch, in which case, how can he wear it to school in Harnoff? Yeah, or it's a false Rolex watch, in which case everyone's going, wow, that's a really amazing. Like, what's he doing? He was interested. Well, he didn't actually have to, because within 2 days all the bits fell off the watch, and therefore it actually was only a shiner for 24 hours. Right, now, from B to C,
see areas where there has been a shift, a big shift, a fundamental shift. The issues may be the same kind of issues, but maybe a lot's changed, and maybe the way the Gemara deals with them is not the way they people deal with them today. And these get more and more difficult as we go on. Again, the first section was things which haven't changed, the second section was things which really haven't changed, but the cases have changed. Have a look at C. These are more controversial, and you may feel some of these are a little bit shocking, problematic maybe. And that's good, because we'll deal with them. Number four. There's an interesting case in the Gemara there. Shor shel hekdesh, v'shor shel Yisrael, shenagach l'shor shel oved kachavim. An ox owned by a Jew damages an ox owned by a non-Jew, says the Mishnah here, patur, he's exempt. V'shel oved kachavim shenagach l'shor shel Yisrael, but if the ox of the non-Jew damages the ox of the Jew, mashalem netik shalem, then he's liable for full payment. So if the Jew damages the non-Jew's property, according to this halacha, he gets off, and if the non-Jew damages to the Jew's property, according to the halacha, the non-Jew has to pay. Why? So the Gemara has a whole discussion as to why it is that the non-Jew is liable, because of this, because of that. This raises a very interesting question. The Gemara has a lot to say about Jews and non-Jews. And some of it is quite negative about non-Jews. Does this still apply today? Is this still the same framework that we live in today? Are the non-Jewish society around us the same non-Jewish society that there was at a time when there were pagans, when people really were? You know, the time of the Romans, civilization, quotes and quotes, was not the same as it is today. There were people running around chopping each other's heads off. There were people doing child worship, you know, sacrifice. There were people, pagans of all types, of all... They're still pagans? There are still
people children.
Yes, that's true. There are people still who do sell children. There aren't many people who kill them to gods, but there are actually, because they were in London. There was a whole case recently of a whole of voodoo cults that were chopping up children and throwing them in the Thames. It was a whole business. Do you remember that? It was a whole thing. But so, you know, maybe you could say nothing's changed. But in some ways, it's very intuitive to us. We feel that, well, just, I don't know, society's just different today. And in case you feel that's just a very modern, wishy-washy, liberal approach, it's really not. Because the Meiri, who lived 500, 600, 700 years ago, he lived in the 1300s in France, says like this, number five, on this particular halacha. Lefi Reshem Nama Gemara, according to what the Gemara says there about the rights and responsibilities of Jews and non-Jews, he says, Dafka ba'amimim she'enum gedurim bedarchi datos venimusim. That's only talking about a society which is not bound by the rule of law, where things were random, where people could get just taken off without notice, without due process, thrown in jail, killed, whatever. Aval kol she'sheva mitzvahs b'yadom, but if we're dealing with non-Jews who keep the seven mitzvahs of B'nai Noach, meaning they're moral, ethical people, dinam etzleinu k'dineinu etzlam, their halacha to us is the same as our halacha to them. We don't have any kind of bias or favoritism one way or the other to Jew or to non-Jew. And that certainly is true of today's people, he says, in his day. And I don't know, you can debate whether medieval society was even civilized compared to our society. But he feels that all of these halachas in the Gemara have to be reinterpreted in light of modern day, in his day anyway, circumstances. Now, that's certainly going to apply today, all the more so. But the question is, do we accept this? Does everyone accept this Meiri? And you see that there's a very big debate in the Jewish world today between those, perhaps more in the more modern society, Orthodox society I'm talking about, who very much take this Meiri and want to run with it and want to say, look, you know, the Gemara says things about non-Jews. They're not our non-Jews. They're not our neighbours. That's not the same people. Different people in the Meiri. And others, perhaps, who are more rooted in a more traditional approach, who say, nah, Jews and non-Jews, it's all the same, nothing's changed. You want to say the 20th century is civilized? You must be joking, okay? 20th century was the most uncivilized century on earth. More people were killed in the 20th century by murder and crimes against humanity than in any other century. Don't tell me that things have got better. I can hear both sides of the argument, but that's going to make a big difference when you ask your Shiloh about how to deal with this, that, and the other in contemporary society. Yes, Michelle?
Just for this example, how is it even possible that we could hold
No.
Why are they going to care that they're
okay, fine. So the answer is, obviously, if people don't care, they don't care. But the halacha deals with the whole world. The halacha is not just for the Jewish people. The halacha is, and the Torah is, for the entire world. And that's why we have a concept of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, which is there are seven mitzvahs that we expect the non-Jewish world to keep in order to have, you know, a status of someone who is God-fearing and has a place in the world to come. The Rambam says explicitly that a place in the world to come is not an exclusive right for Jews. It's for all humans. Anyone who has a human soul, which is a divine soul, has a right to a place in the world to come. If you have a possibility of achieving the world to come, there has to be responsibilities in order to achieve that. Who decides that? There has to be some kind of objective standard. I can't say, well, you can have a place in the world to come if you think you're good enough to have a place in the world to come. It doesn't mean anything. So everybody thinks they're goody-goody. Well, not everybody, but most people. And therefore we have halachas, which are in the Torah before the Torah was given. If you look in Parshas Noach and other places, and in the Gemara, and which deal with, you know, can a non-Jew marry another non-Jew's wife? Is that allowed? Is that okay? Do non-Jews have no halacha? Can non-Jewish brothers and sisters sleep with each other? Is that fine by us? Well, you're not Jewish, so we don't care. Think about it. Obviously, can non-Jewish people steal? Can non-Jewish people murder? Clearly not. And therefore, we have halachas that deal with that. We'll see, when we deal with the case of abortion, that it could be that in some areas, the halacha of a non-Jew is different from the halacha for Jews. We may see, when we see abortion, that the halacha of abortion is stricter for non-Jews than it is for Jews, which we'll get to when we get there. That's because there are different halachic systems. But nevertheless, this question of what is the status of these different people is relevant today and maybe has shifted today. Let's look at number six. Number six is dealing with Jews. The case of apikorsim. What is an apikorus? What's an apikorus? A heretic. What do we do with heretics? Burn them! No, that's not true. We don't do that. The question is, who is a heretic? What are these people? The Gemara makes some very sweeping statements about certain people. Have a look in number six. Tana Rabbi Avo, Kemed Rabbi Yochanan. Ha'oiv de kachon v'roi behema daka. People who are shepherds and pagans. Shepherds were assumed to be very immoral people by the Gemara, because on the whole, shepherds were particularly lax about their morality of theft. They let their animals graze everywhere and take everyone's property, etc. Anyway, that's not for now. I'm not dealing with shepherds. You probably don't know any shepherds. You know any shepherds?
No.
No? No one lives in...
no
one from Milwaukee or anywhere like that? Maybe, I don't know. Anyway, so... What does it say? What happens if they're drowning in the sea? You don't have to rescue them. But you shouldn't push them in. Oh. Aval, but haminim, but heretics, the hamoisras, and people who give and informants, people who go over to become informants for the enemies of the Jewish people, the hamumarim, and people who convert maybe to other religions, hayumoyridim v'loy malin. Not only do you not have to fish them out of the lake, but if you can give them a bit of a in the lake, then you've done a service to humanity. I mean, this is how we behave. This is what we do. I mean, what defines an apikorus? If you don't believe in God, oh, you're a heretic. Oh, so everyone who doesn't believe in God, in the lake. Like, I don't think so. What about, today we live in a society, again, the paradigm at the time of the Gemara, and up until really 300 years ago, is a Jew who didn't subscribe to the Jewish belief system had made a conscious decision to break with and defect from Judaism. That was the case. If you didn't want to be religious 500 years ago, you had to be Christian or Muslim or something else. And there were Jews who converted to Christianity and Islam. Today that's not the case. Today every single person in this room knows hundreds and hundreds of people who don't believe in anything that a Jewish person is meant to believe in, simply because they just didn't have any Jewish education. That's just the situation. Not because they've rebelled in any way, not because they've rejected anything in any way. Of course there are individual cases, but they're rare and few and far between. Do we say the same thing today? We're going to be talking about the 13 Ikrim in our Wednesday class. The 13 Ikrim, the Rambam says, if you don't believe in the 13 Ikrim, you're a min, you're an apikorus, you're a heretic, etc., etc. Great. So, like, people who don't believe that Torah is from heaven, so they're all finished? They're all in the lake? Is that what we do today? So one of the top answers is no, by the way. It's not what we do today. In case you're... but the question is why? Is it just because we're all now wishy-washy and we just don't really keep the halakha properly, and if we were really, you know, stark, we would push everyone in the lake? No, chas v'chalila, God forbid, that's not the case at all. The case is the kind of people they were talking about, and not the kind of people you're thinking about when you think of people who don't keep Torah. They're just different, just a different situation. There's been a fundamental paradigm shift. Non-religious people today are just not the same as non-religious people 1,000 years ago, to 300 years ago. And therefore, to what extent can we apply these halachas? Maybe we have to apply different halachas. Is that where we're going to get them from? We're going to deal with that when we deal with these topics. Again, these are teasers. These are not answers. These are just questions. But these are the kind of things. Here's one which you might find interesting. Number 7, really famous one, this one. Tana Rabbi Eliyahu. Hoyel v'nashim dasan kalois aleihem. Women are dasan kalois. Women have a weak das. What does das mean?
Knowledge.
Knowledge. What does that mean? Now again, this is very misunderstood. It doesn't mean women are stupid. It never meant that. Chazal all knew some very, very clever women. Bruria, for example, was one of the Tanaim. Bruria argues with other Tanaim, and we paskin like Bruria. Yeah? So don't tell me that Chazal thought women were stupid. That's clearly not the truth. But the fact, the truth is that women were very differently educated to the way women are educated today. Women were very differently educated to men in those days, up until very recently. Don't forget, it's only about 100 years ago that women were allowed into universities. I'm not talking about religious society, I'm talking about any society. Even when I was at college, there were all male colleges. Okay, women were allowed in other colleges, but they weren't allowed in some colleges. When my mother-in-law, who is a judge, won the first prize, she just retired recently, she won the first prize for coming top in the bar exams in 1960, whatever it was, the rule was that a woman was not allowed to win the first prize. So she had to get the second prize. And the guy who came second, he had to get the first prize. No, that's how it was. The world was a different world. Today, women, obviously that's not a Jewish thing, that was in the legal system in England. Today, women are educated to entirely the same level as men across the board. There are women chief executive officers of major companies, there are women prime ministers, presidents. There are people in every walk of life. When Chazal say things about women, is that today's women? Or is that just women then? That's a big hashgafic question. You're going to get a very different answer to that question if you go to Nishmat or if you go to Neveh. They're all dealing with the same sources. They're all dealing with the same issue, which is these sources in the Gemara say X, Y, and Z. But the question is, to what extent do you say, well, no, the paradigm shift today is means you can't apply that anymore in the same way. You had a question?
Yeah. Who is it that is, you know, today deciding the changes?
Oh, that's a good question, which we will have to deal with. I mean, the answer is the poskim, the gedolei hador, the people who lead the halachic process. And the question is, what drives them? And things do change. Things change a lot. Things often change incrementally rather than in big shifts. But when you look back, the very fact that you're sitting around the table here in this seminary, the very fact that hundreds of thousands of girls go to Beis Yaakov schools, is radical, radical, radical compared to what would have been even thought of 100 years ago. Radical. Why did that happen? Because people realized, including the leading halachic poskim of the generation, some of them anyway, that things had to change. That the way that things had been done up till then couldn't be the way that they were done from now on, for all sorts of reasons. Now, it doesn't mean that we end up in Reform Judaism, where, well, everything's got to change. And where you draw that line is, the problem is, the Orthodox world in many ways has been forced to react against a very progressive Reform world, and therefore often ends up saying, well, nothing can change. Well, that's not true. It's not true to say that nothing changes. Not that things change. And in fact, the line is a very much more sensitive and a nuanced line somewhere in the middle, which we're going to have to discuss more as we go along. But women's education is a classic example of that. Yes?
Sorry, could you translate the Nashim Da'atan Kalos?
Literally, it means women, Da'atan, their mind, or their knowledge, not their mind, their knowledge. Kalot is light. Now, that could be talking about emotional responses, and the truth is, it is true to say, in generalized terms, that men and women have different emotional responses in standardized situations, obviously not with everybody. It may be talking about that to some degree, but it can also be talking about general educational levels. Women were illiterate in past years. There's no question about that. Today they're not. and therefore we're going to have to raise certain questions. By the way, it was when the original halakhic question came up as to whether women should vote or women should not vote 100 years ago, it was pretty unanimous across the board that it was inappropriate for women to vote.
Whoa.
I'm not going to lie to you and say that that wasn't the case.
Wait, who voted on that?
Now, I very much doubt that you'll find any post-sec in the world who says that it's halakhically problematic for a woman to vote. What happened?
Who
changed it? Who decides this? And in fact, not just that, but in Israel, there are religious Haredi parties that will arrange your babysitter to enable you to get out and vote so that you can register your vote, because every vote counts. What happened to the halakhic problems with women voting? The answer is, they've disappeared. Why they disappeared? Because the nature of society has changed. That's why they've disappeared. Yes?
I'm a little confused about how this works exactly. Like, when someone makes a comment like that, is he looking at how people are inherently based on the Torah, or is he looking at society? Because it was my impression that, like, these Torah scholars are cultural
relativists.
Like,
correct. And very often we'll see when Chazal makes certain statements, they are making objective statements based on halachic objective realities. And we'll see Rav Soloveitchik has a lot to say about that. He's very insistent that Torah doesn't shift and blow with the winds and change as society changes. That's true. On the other hand, there are certain things that clearly are said which are clearly cultural. When the Rambam talks about women and Talmud Torah, for example, he says, and the Gemara says clearly, that women should not be encouraged in certain areas of Talmud Torah. And the Rambam gives a reason for that. He says, because the majority of women do not have the educational tools to be able to learn the Torah properly. Which is a fact. That's not a statement about, that's not misogynist. That's not a statement about values or capabilities. That's just a statement of fact. Now, when the halacha is based on a statement of fact of that nature, when that statement of fact shifts to a different fact, the question is, how can that first halacha still apply in the same way? It's not that it's relative, it's that it was based on a certain presumption, and that presumption is now no longer there. You understand what I'm saying?
I do, but then the halacha is being... It's not like the halacha came down this one way and it's just being differentially interpreted. It's being differently ruled.
Correct. And some
based on the reality of the world.
That's because some halachas do depend on a reality of the world, and some halachas do not. The halachas of kashrus don't depend whether you're living in Egypt, you know, in the 14th century, or New York in the 21st century. If the Rambam came today to teach the halachas of kashrus in Midrash Rachel, and no doubt he would feel very comfortable teaching in Midrash Rachel. Okay, everyone claims the Rambam for their own. He teaches kashrus just exactly the way he taught it in Fostat in Egypt in the 14th century, in the 12th century. But if you ask the Rambam to come and teach the halachas of how to respect parents, do you think he teaches exactly the same? Is the relationship between parents and children in 21st century New York the same as the relationship between parents and children 700 years ago in the Middle East? Can you teach the same halacha in the same way? But when it says in the halacha that the way you speak to your parents is in the most respectful way, and the most respectful way is in the third person, does that apply today? You're going to say to your parents, you know, does father wish to sit down? Now, you laugh, but there was a time not that long ago when that's exactly how you spoke. That's exactly how you spoke to your parents. You called your father sir. You called your father sir. And you didn't speak unless you were spoken to. And if you did, you got a whack around the face. That's how life was. Is the relationship between husbands and wives, that when you talk about Shalom Bayis, when people teach the halachas of Shalom Bayis, do you think they teach them the same now as they taught them 800 years ago?
No.
Now, 800 years ago, it doesn't mean everything changes. It doesn't mean that it's just like throw it all away and start again. Of course not. Even 500 years ago, when the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch is talking about wife beating, and is saying that wife beating is an obnoxious practice which is completely prevalent in the non-Jewish world, which it was, but should never be countenanced in the Jewish world. So there we drew a line and said, you know, hitting any other person in anger is unacceptable, whoever they are. That was always an absolute. But for sure, the relationship between husbands and wives used to be much more a dominant and a subordinate in many ways, and depending on the society, than it is today. Today it's a partnership. It depends where you grow up. If you're Sephardi, if you're Ashkenazi, there may still be different expectations as to what the relationship is between husbands and wives. But again, so certain halachic areas have built into them a certain level of, well, is that still applicable today? And certain ones don't. Shabbos is Shabbos. Shabbos has always been Shabbos. Yes?
When we say that we want Mashiach to come, we want the
yes.
Messianic
era
to come,
mm-hmm.
does that mean that it's going to go back to the way things were before?
No.
So it's still like...
The our concept of Mashiach is not some kind of return to... you know, medieval, pre-whatever life, where we're all going to throw our cars away, drive horses and carts. Nah, people think all sorts of nonsense, you know. But the Rambam says explicitly, and we'll have classes on Mashiach if we get the opportunity. What changes when Mashiach comes is not that we all revert to some kind of ancient world. It's that some things happen, like the Jewish people return to the land of Israel. Now, I'll tell you something. 100 years ago, people thought of the concept of a state of Israel as an ancient concept and couldn't imagine there being a modern equivalent of a Jewish people living in a Jewish land, because the only paradigm that they had for that was 2,000 years old. The way that you... Can you imagine a temple being built today? To you, it feels like some kind of, oh, wow, ancient this and that. The way you relate to the possibility of a temple is the way that your great-great-grandparents relate to the possibility of a Jewish country. To you, it's a modern thing. Of course, a Jewish country. There's roads and there's traffic wardens and there's Angel Bakery and that. This is all a modern miracle. This was all inconceivable 100 years ago. So Mashiach, you know, there will be some things that come back, like the Beis HaMikdash, but there'll be, you know, the main change will be a paradigm shift in attitude. People won't want to kill each other, which is a pretty big thing. Yes.
Okay.
We must get through the end, but yes.
Okay, just one more point.
Yes.
If certain things have remained constant. Certain things were like pustened on then, and that was acceptable, and they're pustened on today, and that is acceptable, like
right.
Based on our different societies.
Yes.
That means that we should, like, we can't say then that, you know, for a relationship to be dominant and subordinate, or for children to be treated in whatever way by their parents, like, you can't say that that's not within the bounds of Torah.
It is certainly within the bounds of Torah.
So yeah, so there's many, like...
But of course it is.
It's not wrong that women shouldn't be able to vote according to Torah.
No.
It's just that it could be okay.
I didn't understand the last bit.
Sorry. It's not unacceptable that women shouldn't be able to vote according to Torah. It's just within the bounds of acceptableness.
You mean it's...
Should be able to
it's, vote. It's not... You're saying you mean it wouldn't be a negative thing for a Torah perspective to say that women should not vote. That wouldn't be a bad thing. It's just that it says that they can't.
Within the bounds of what could be acceptable.
I don't know if you're right.
If I'm right, you're telling me that however many years ago, that's
right.
What the rabbi said.
Right, and that was what they said, and they were right in the society in which they lived. And I'm not sure if they came and they said the same thing today, that you could say that was an acceptable opinion.
Right.
I'm not sure.
She's saying both sides are.
I'm saying they're both within the bounds of what is acceptable.
Yes, yes, correct. But I'm just saying that certain things do shift within the bounds of halacha. Halacha expects them to shift. I give you an interesting example. That some mitzvahs are framed in a more objective way, and some are framed in a slightly more subjective way. The concept of beged ish, that a woman is not allowed to wear a man's clothing, and a man is not allowed to wear a woman's clothing. Did Moshe Rabbeinu come down from Har Sinai with a list of acceptable clothing for all time, and say, this is the list of things that men can wear, and this is the list of things that women can wear? The answer is no. The nature of the mitzvah is that the mitzvah says that in any given society, men cannot do that which is effeminate in that society, and women cannot do that which is masculine in that society. And if you live in Scotland, then the men wear skirts, so that's fine. That's not begging Isha. And if you live in New York, the men don't wear skirts. Well, normally the way everything goes in New York. Okay? You see, so there is an example of a mitzvah which is very subjectively framed because of the nature of the mitzvah. On the other hand, kashrus is very objectively framed. It's not that pigs were dirty in the old days, so they were trained. and now pigs are clean and therefore they're kosher. That's not the case at all. Trafe is trafe and kosher is kosher. And one of the things you have to develop is a bit of a feel for when things do change and when things don't change, and how that works, which we'll get over the year. I can't go into the whole year now in one lesson. I'm just flagging it as an issue which is we have to get to grips with. Okay, let's do a couple of others. I've got two of the women's ones here in number 8 and 9, which I'll deal with really quickly because I want to finish at 5:30. Number 8 is talking about a woman making kiddush. Rule. Paskin is to rule. To rule. Bye-bye. It's all right. Thanks. Don't worry. Let me just finish with these... well, not finish. Let me just do 8 and 9 and then go on to the last ones. The halacha here, the Mishnah Berurah, talks about a woman being asked to make kiddush for a large group of men. Just in principle, can a woman make kiddush for her family, for her husband, for her family on Friday night? Yes or no?
Yes,
halachically there is no reason why she can't. Men and women have the same obligation in kiddush. It tends to be the custom that men make kiddush, but that's not necessary to say that it's impossible the other way around. But should a woman make kiddush for a whole group of men who are not her family? So the Mishnah Berurah here mentions that he feels it's not correct. Why? But he gives a reason. It says, the last two words, the zila milsa. It cheapens the mitzvah. Cheapens the mitzvah a little bit. It's like, what does that mean? Does that mean that if you ask a woman to do something, it makes it less important for the crowd? Is that a statement of the way that women were viewed, the way that women understood halacha? Is that still the case? Is that not the case? If you ask a woman to give a Dvar Torah in shul, is that sanua or is that not sanua? Different question to this. An interesting question.
Modest.
Is that modest? Sorry, correct that. Is it appropriate for a woman to walk to the front of the shul and give a speech? Yes or no? And that will depend on who you ask. But the people from the Orthodox world who feel that is appropriate, feel that's appropriate because, again, they feel that 100 years ago it would not have been appropriate, but today it is appropriate. Those people who say it's still not appropriate say, well, no, you think they've changed. But things do change, because even there, women have adopted different roles in society. The difference between the societies, one society says things do change, and one society pretends that things don't change, but they do change. Okay? But again, not for now. You can't judge any conclusions on basis on what I said today alone. You have to go through the course. Number 9 is even more controversial. I haven't even got the time or energy to get into it now, which is a statement by Chazal about women in marriage and whether women would prefer to be married or not married. It's a whole different question which we'll maybe deal with when we deal with other issues. Let's deal with the last page, going from bottom of 10. Just flag up a few questions which you would say are completely new. Because so far, we've been talking about issues which are either the same but different cases, or shifts in paradigm but roughly the same issues. But what about totally new issues? Turning on lights and chants. I'm sure you've been asked by people who've challenged you. Moses didn't have electricity. Moses didn't say you can't turn off lights on Shabbos. So why on earth, who invented such a ridiculous idea that you can't turn off the light? That's not work, is it? I'm sure if you haven't been asked that question, I'd be stupefied. Okay? Of course, electricity is an entirely new issue, right? They didn't have electricity 2,000 years ago. They didn't have any concepts of electricity 2,000 years ago. So how can the Talmud talk about electricity? So we'll see. We'll have probably a whole class dealing with these kind of issues. Sometimes you just have to analyse what does the electricity do. For example, turning on a light on Shabbos, how does a light work? What is a light? An old-fashioned filament light bulb. How does it?
Spark.
No, it's not a spark.
Spark.
Which does what?
Light.
It heats a piece of metal until it burns and glows white. That gives you a light bulb. It's just a piece of hot metal. Nothing remarkable. It's just a piece. You didn't do physics at school, okay? It's just a piece of hot metal. Remember in your physics classes where they drew pictures of light bulbs? You know, whatever. The point is like this. Do you think the Gemara talks about heating up metal on Shabbat until it gets very hot and glows? Do you think that's possible?
Yeah.
Of course it does. They didn't have metal 2,000 years ago? Of course they do. Of course they did. So if you heated up metal and made it glow 2,000 years ago, and you heat up metal and make it glow today, then what's the difference? The answer is the Gemara talks, of course, about turning on lights on Shabbat. Oh, what about fluorescent lights?
Yeah.
They don't have any metal in them. It's just a load of argon gas but yet excited and glows. Do you expect that Chazal talk about excited gas? No, they don't. Because they didn't know about argon, or if they did, they didn't say, and they didn't know about fluorescent light bulbs. And therefore, when we have to pass in the halakha fluorescent light bulbs, where are we going to get that source from? And that's going to be more of a challenge. Because we can't just take an analogy from something in the Gemara and just transpose it to today, because that analogy is not always obvious. Sometimes it's there, but you don't realize. Let me give you an interesting source in source 12. Tosfos in Ksuvos is one of my favorite Tosfos. Have a look at Tosfos. Tosfos was a 12th, 13th century group of commentators in France and Germany. They say, Karl Markham, we find many situations which are really impossible or not common. Where the Gemara talks about them. Why does the Gemara talk about very abstract cases? You ever got this feeling when you're learning Gemara sometimes? That it talks about very unusual cases. And your implication, your inclination rather, is to say, oh, come on. Now, the truth is, there's a reason why a legal system has to deal with difficult cases to define the law. That's not what I'm talking about now. But says Tosfos, sometimes it's so ridiculously unreal that I can't think of any reason why it does it, other than in order for us to just learn and get reward for learning. It's just because it gives us reward for learning. And he gives an example, kedamina, as they say, mahu hibik shnei rachamim v'yatam izeh mahu. If you take two animals and you back them up against each other, and one of them's pregnant, about to have a baby, and the embryo comes out of animal A, and you back up animal B, just aligned so that the embryo comes down, the baby, the little calf is born, it goes whoop into animal B, spends a little bit of time rolling around animal B, and then comes out of animal B. The Gemara asks, what's the halacha? Who is the mother? Is it animal A? Is it animal B? Says the Tosfos Olivia's question. Even though it's not possible, you don't have to be a farmer to know that you shouldn't try this one at home. When worse, you just have a big mess all over the carpet.
Because if they knew that there were going to be situations in the future that they couldn't predict now.
Oh, so that source, which Tosfos is mystified by, right, in the 12th century, what possible use could it have?
In vitro.
Today is a classic source. It deals with embryos, genetic mothers, surrogate mothers, birth mothers, mother A, mother B, out of this one into this one. Nowadays, these sources are very, very sort of activated. You get things like that. You have source in number 13 that talks about if you have someone who is part creature, part animal, part person, part human, part animal, what is the halakhic status of that person? Does it impart ritual impurity, like a person, like an animal? How does that work? Are there part animal, part people? Well, they can grow organs on animals. They can transplant animal organs into people. You can have people who've got bits of animals in them. You can have animals which have got bits of people growing on them.
Yeah.
All over the world, people do this. And in fact, what we're seeing is very often there are sources there. There are sources there that do this, that do talk about this. The ear mouse. Is it around this ear mouse?
Yeah, the ear mouse.
Although that's a bit of a mistake, because it wasn't really a human ear that was growing on the mouse.
No, it was
prosthetic. It was based on human. Anyway, even rather sort of mundane cases, like what is the status of a toilet? Is a toilet a toilet? Your whole life thought a toilet was a toilet. But you may be laboring under a massive misapprehension. Because there are halakhas of toilets that are brought down in the Gemara. You can't say a brocha in a toilet. You can't put a mezuzah on a toilet. You can't think of Torah in a toilet. You can't think of all sorts of things. Why? Because it's filthy, it's smelly, it's dirty. Toilets, up until 100 years ago, were filthy, smelly, disgusting, horrible places, which were basically the heaps on the ground that you didn't want to go close to. That's what they were. That's what they were. The human race lived in a state of dirty toilets until 100 years ago. All of a sudden, now you go to people's bathrooms, they're like, you know, they're cleaner than kitchens, no? You go they're spraying, that you could eat off the floor in the bathroom.
They take toilet seats. they're cleaner than door handles.
Mm. And they're cleaner than computer keyboards.
Oh, yeah.
Computer keyboards are the worst. Now, I'm asking you now. So today's toilets, are they really toilets? You walk in a toilet today, which is clean. I'm not saying it smells or is bad. Just a clean toilet, which is like all smell and fresh, smells like a citrus fruits. Can you say a bracha? Can you think Torah? Does this have a dinner in a toilet? So there's a Gemara that talks about a toilet which is like self-flushing. And whether it has a dinner in a toilet, whether it doesn't have a dinner in a toilet. So again, you're going to have to deal with those sources when you deal with that. And the last thing I'll leave you with on 16 is more of a science question, which is sometimes halachas appear to be based on scientific data, which nowadays is not considered to be correct. Does that mean the halacha changes? Or does that mean that no, Chazal didn't just base it on that, but they based it on other things, Chazal the rabbis, Talmudic rabbis. I give you the example they bring, which is that the Gemara says explicitly, even though you're not allowed to kill any animal on Shabbat, you are allowed to kill lice on Shabbat. It's said in the Gemara.
Okay.
Now, why are you allowed to kill lice on Shabbat? Because, says the Gemara, lice do not reproduce through normal sexual reproduction. They don't have mummy lice and daddy lice and baby lice. They spontaneously generate from food. That was the common scientific understanding of the entire world until around 300 years ago, that certain things just spontaneously generate. Now, science clearly understands that that is not the case. There are mummy lice and daddy lice and little egg lice. They're just very, very small and you can't see them without a microscope. And that's how the lice get there. So now let me ask you a question. Now that I'm going to tell you lice do reproduce in a normal way, so can you still kill them on Shabbos? Because the halacha says you can, but can you?
Yeah.
But then you're going against the Gemara. The Gemara said that you can.
You do.
You do. But the Gemara gives the reason. So it's that's just one of the questions we'll have to deal with, which we will, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, deal with. Is another example of where things may change. Okay, hopefully that gives you a taster. More to come, Be'ezrat Hashem.